Get ready. It's time to tee it up with Keith Jones.
Coming up on today's show, we make time for Toski as we welcome the great legendary Bob Toski for a fireside chat. So stay tuned and get ready as you tee it up with Keith Jones. Welcome to the show. So glad you belong. You know it is time for Toski. You know, we just can't help ourselves. The guy's going to be 100 years old pretty soon. And that's not even this year. But, I digress. Like, Michelangelo celebrated a birthday and is 550 years old. So Bob's got nothing on that. Toski, you got a ways to go on that. Michelangelo. Oh, what? Michelangelo's? He's no longer with us. I see. But he's would be 550 this year. So anyway.
Is that a true story?
That is a true story. Yeah, I made up a lot of things in my life, but I try to only tell the truth on this show because I've been doing it for a long time, and I got great guests, and my guests never lie either. Now, fabrication. Right. Although this hour, I wanted it to be super special for people. Now, anybody who listens to this show knows Bob Toski is a regular contributor, and we're always pleased to make time for Toski. But I want to have like a fireside chat with Grandpa. And he's some people's grandpa, and he's other people's father, and the guy's been around since almost since dirt now. But Bob is the last living link to one of the greatest eras ever in sports, and specifically in golf. Leading money winner in 1954 on the PGA Tour, which at that time was just an inkling of what it's become. But the great players that Bob played with and trained with and drove around the country with and such. I mean, you know, I never can get enough of that. And I talk to people all the time and like, man, I need more of that. So we're going to do that this hour. And Bob's memory is much longer than his years on earth, which is saying something there. But Bob, welcome to the show. It's always a pleasure to have you on. And the floor is yours, my man. This is why I enjoy talking with legends, true legends like yourself.
Well, I appreciate all the accolades. I hope I can come up with the right answers.
It's not even about answers. It's just telling the stories. And, you know, as the great John Fogerty said not that long ago, enough people have died that now I own my music again. So I feel like that's kind of how it is. You could tell stories, and you actually could make them up, and people would not be able to contest them because anybody else is no longer with us. But you never do that. You always have the greatest memory and the greatest stories.
I wouldn't tell a story unless I knew it was the real thing. I'm not that good a liar.
Well, see, there you go. So people are really in for a super special treat this hour. Bob has. So you've told the story in the past about how you got into golf. Now, I'll start there only from a standpoint of I was listening to Michael Wan, who used to be the commissioner of the LPGA, and he left the LPGA to be in charge of the USGA once Mike Davis decided he wanted to go and do golf course design. So Mike was telling us how great the growth of golf was as far as more people getting into it. Not the traditional, but the youth, which you've all long time supported, the females, and then people of color. Now, I tell people white is a color too, but that's not the point here. It's just that there are other people who were never exposed to the game of golf that are now into the golf. So, which is great because the recreational golf rounds are up and the millions of people who are coming into the game are deciding, hey, maybe I can stay in the game because they're making it more user-friendly. So you got involved. You know, you're a little Polish boy, and at that time when you were growing up, you know, you probably were called a few names because of that. But that's how society can be, and you grow from that, and you go from that.
True. I started playing golf when I was 6 years old.
So why 6 years old? Because, I mean, that's kind of old. Tiger started playing when he was three.
Well, he probably had more opportunities to start that younger, but I didn't have that. I went to play golf when I was 6 years old because my mother had passed away trying to have her 10th child, and the child, and my mother passed, and the child died, and my mother passed away, so we were invited to go to Northampton Country Club, where my brother was an assistant. Al Porter and Minnie Porter owned the country club, and they put me up in the attic with my brother Tommy, who was 1 year older than me. And my brother Jack cut down a 6-iron and a putter, and he says, "All you're going to do is chip and putt, chip and putt." And I did that until I got old enough to be able to swing a driver. And so that was the way I got started in golf. But I took the golf like a duck taking the water. And I just fell in love with the sport. And never in my life did I think I'd ever be a golfer that I am, and was, rather. And meet people like, well, let's take a name called Walter Hagen. And would you like to have me tell you the story about how I met Walter Hagen?
Of course. Walter Hagen, one of the greatest golfers of all time.
Here I am. This is 1950, and I just started on the tour full time. I'm at Red Run Country Club up in Detroit, playing in the Motor City Open at that time. And the parking lot had to be almost 50 yards long, wide, whatever. And Ted Kroll and I would travel together, and we were on we were on the front end of the parking lot, and here comes this guy named Walter Hagen walking up from the other end, and Ted had a tendency to stutter a little bit, and he said, "Call me Swifty," and he said, "Swifty, here comes Walter Hagen." So I said, "Ted, let's just believe we're taking our clubs out of our trunk, and so we won't think like he's coming by us." So I'm trying to fake it, and all of a sudden, Walter Hagen taps me on the shoulder. And he says, "Are you Bob Toski?" I said, "Mr. Hagen, yes, I am." He said, "Well, Walter Bercomo, who he was walking with," and he said, "Walter Bercomo told me that I should introduce myself to you." And so I had the presence of mind to tell him that my brother Jack idolized Walter Hagen. I said, "Mr. Hagen, do you mind if I tell you about my brother Jack, who thought you were God?" I said, "He drank like you, smoked like you, chased women like you, but I said he couldn't play like you." So I was caddying for him in this pro-am, and I'm telling Mr. Hagen that on the par 5 hole, the first hole, he hits a great drive, and that he's going to go for the green in 2. And as you know, when you try to hit, your stance was always pretty wide. You had a big waggle. And I knew he's going to let the shaft out because his stance got wider, his waggle got bigger, and I knew he's going to let the shaft out. So I was caddying for him, and all of a sudden, he takes a swing at the ball and tops it. The ball didn't go 50 yards. And I said to him, "Jack, you may dress like Hagen, you may smoke like Hagen, but you don't play like Hagen." Well, that ended my caddying career. He chased me back to the clubhouse, and I never finished caddying the first hole. And Hagen was laughing so hard, he says, "Whoa, Bob, what a great story." I said, "Well, my brother Jack idolized you, but he tried to play like you, but he didn't have your talent." And he says, I just love that story. So that was how I met Walter Hagen.
And what was it about Hagen that made him such a good golfer?
Well, I think psychologically, he thought he was better than everybody. He had an air about him that aired confidence. And he's almost like a gambler, if you're playing for money. He knew how to win. And he had a style that when he drove, when he played, he walked fast. He hit a drive, and he, by the time he the ball was 10 feet in the air, he's walking off the tee. He moved very quickly. And, of course, he did something in golf that never had been done in the history of the game. When he won the British Open, and he wanted to go in the clubhouse and have some food, but they wouldn't allow him to come. They treated golfers, the British treated golfers, professional golfers, like caddies. And he told the powers to be in a clubhouse to bring a table outside and put some linen over the table. And he said, we're going to order champagne, because he won the Open. And then they served him outside. He had dinner or lunch outside. And that was the beginning of Hagen trying to prove that a winner in golf was not a caddy. He was the image he created for the golfer, the American golfer, or any golfer for that matter of fact. A lot of people don't know that he did that, but they gave him the opportunity to have lunch outside, and he celebrated that like a true gentleman. So that's my story about Walter Hagen.
So, Bob, when did the British change their thought on professional golfers? Because now they're highly respected and considered the champion golfer of the year. So you're not, you know, trying to be beyond the U.S. Open and all those other winners like the Masters and stuff. The champion golfer of the year with not the British Open, but the Open Championship.
Well, we go back to Hagen again. He had the courage to ask the powers to be in the clubhouse, the president or whoever he talked with, said, I'm going to have, now you've got to understand, he's a British Open champion. So he's using his title and his way of talking to people that was very influential. So he did something to elevate the professional golfer like no other player that I know. And from that day on, I think the image of the professional golfer stood much higher than ever before. But I think we have to go all the way back to when golf was invented by the Scotch or the English or whoever. And, of course, it was a game of royalty, the queen and the king, and it was a game of royalty. And of course, now what we see in America, as you said, the growth of golf is played by a farmer or carpenter or whatever. It's not just a person of royalty or high standard of living. So the game has changed.
We're Fireside Chatting with Bob Totsky. We'll be back. We'll be right back. We are back spending the hour with Bob Toski, doing a little fire chat with Grandpa. This guy is so knowledgeable, not just about the game, but been around the greats of the game. In the last segment, Bob, you told a great story about how you met Walter Hagen. Who came after that on the PGA Tour that was of influence to you?
Well, before the PGA Tour, at 16, Gene Sarazen and Babe Zaharias played a nine-hole exhibition at Northampton Country Club. And my brother Benny was the third player. And I caddied for Benny. And Jack was my oldest brother, and he naturally was in the gallery. And after the exhibition was over, my brother Jack, as you know, who mentored me, walked up to Sarah's and he said, Gene, you got a minute? And Gene naturally said, yes, Jack. And Jack said, I want you to meet my brother Bob. I was 16 at the time. And he said, I think this young man has got some potential, and I know he wants to become a tour player someday. So Sarazen said to me, come on, the upstairs was the bar, and we went up to the second floor. And he bought me a drink, and he said, Jack is pretty high on you. Tell me, do you have a dream? I said, yes, I have a dream. I have a dream that someday I will want to play on tour and see if I have the ability as a player and have the courage and the discipline to win. He said, well, let me tell you something about a dream. When you dream, you dream while you're sleeping, and you don't know how long that dream lasts. But he said, if you're awake, you better dream that you are going to be successful every minute, every hour, every day of your life until you make that dream happen. So when you go on tour, you've got to feel that your dream will succeed by being consistent and persistent in your attitude toward playing the game of golf. And he said, I won the U.S. Open at the age of 18 because I was a cocky little player Gene Sarazen was an Italian, and he mentored me for about an hour at that bar, and I will now, let's go from the time I was 16 to the first senior tournament in 1980, which is being held at Onion Creek Country Club, where Jimmy DeMarret was the golf director. Now, it's a two-man, two players, best ball, two players. My first partner was Chick Harbert, and Gene Sarazen was playing with Ralph Goodall. And I had put an exhibition on for Jimmy, and he said, well, I don't know if I'll be able to pay you guys if we don't get a big turnout because we have no sponsor. So he was depending on the gate. And after I put the exhibition on, which we had about 1,000 people, he said, how much do I owe you? And I said, Jimmy, are you kidding? I owe you. Because I wasn't qualified under the rules to play in that tournament. And he came up with a new rule called lead money winner and leading Ryder Cup point getter. And that was me, so he got me in the tournament that way. And then he said to me, well, who do you want to play with? I said, I want to play with Gene Sarazen. because I told him the story when I was 16. So he says, well, he's going to tee off at 9 o'clock. Do you want to play that early? I said, we used to be dew sweepers at 7 o'clock in the morning on the tour. And he said, well, we're honoring Gene on the first tee. He's going to be our first honoree. So I'm standing on the tee, and they're giving Gene so many accolades that he finally waves his hand, and he said, that's enough. I'm ready to go.
With the great Bob Toski, we'll be back.
The Dalai Lama. So I'm on a first tee with him. I give him the driver. He hauls off and whacks one. Big hitter. The Lama. Long. Into a 10,000-foot crevice right at the base of this glacier. You know what the Lama says? Gunga Galunga. Gunga, Gunga Galunga.
And we're back with Bob Toski. This hour has turned out so far even beyond what I thought we would be doing, because Bob Toski is a man of the people. He's a guy who has been around and have known the greats of the game. But not only that, he's given back to the game of golf, and he will do that every single day that he's on this side of the dirt. And I'm thinking when he gets to heaven eventually and he's with God at the pearly gates, he's going to say, God, how is your putting doing? So that's Bob Toski in a nutshell to me.
I'll ask God what his handicap is.
And he's going to turn to you and say, Toski, it's now you.
He'll say you.
All right, so Sam Snead was another guy that was so instrumental in your growth, stamina, and your ability to stay out on tour. He really was kind of like a mentor to you. Sam Snead and Jimmy DeMeritt both seem to be like a mentor to you.
Well, yes, Sam always liked to watch me practice and swing, and he'd come over and analyze and make comments about my swing to Ted Kroll, who was my mentor, because he traveled with me. But the story that I like to tell about Jimmy DeMeritt is we were playing in Atlanta, and it was in June, and it was very hot. It was really hot. And DeMeritt, we were out there practicing on the practice tee, and DeMeritt had a pair of shorts on. And he said, Bob, you need to take those long pants off and wear shorts. It's too hot out here to wear long pants. He said, you got any shorts? I said, yeah, I got shorts. He said, go back and put some shorts on. So I did, and I walked back to the practice tee, and when I got up to Jimmy, he looked at me and he said, you shouldn't wear shorts. I said, why? He said, your legs are so skinny they'd shoot you for a rooster. Did you get that one, Keith?
That was pretty good, Bob. That's I was just laughing there internally before I did it outwardly. But that's right. So that was the bluntness of the great Jimmy DeMeritt, certainly one of my all-time favorite golfers, mostly because of television. But between him, who Jimmy was kind of almost sophisticated for the golfing realm, and Sam Snead, who was kind of country boy-ish, you know, some would have called him a hayseed, that kind of thing. That is quite a couple of guys that are watching over you.
Yes, Jimmy was the one that invited me out to dinner every night and introduced me to wine. And the first one I ever drank with Jimmy was Dubonnet. And he would always take me out to dinner and pick up the check. And he always told stories that were so funny that I'd be laughing and I wasn't eating my food. And he says, why don't you start eating? I says, well, you need to stop talking. So so I can finish my dinner. And he adopted me, and of course, meeting guys like Jimmy and Sam, all different personalities. And what a lot of people don't know is Jimmy DeMar changed the color code of dress in golf. He became a very flamboyant dresser. And he was, a lot of people don't know this, but he was admired by Hollywood. He had great actors and both women and men that loved him. And I'll give you a story. I just finished playing in the Riviera Golf Tournament at the L.A. Open, and I walked off the 18th green at Riviera, and you got to walk up about 100 steps to the clubhouse. And on the side of the hill, DeMarit was standing with this man, which I won't mention right now, but as I was walking up the steps, DeMarit hollers down to me. He says, "Are you going to come up and say hello?" So I looked, and I walked up there, and DeMarit said, "I want you to meet a friend of mine named Humphrey Bogart." And I looked at Humphrey Bogart, and I didn't say anything. And he looked at me, and I shook hands with him, and he said, "How you doing, boy?" I says, "Mr. Bogart, I'm doing very well." And that was my introduction to Humphrey Bogart through Jimmy DeMarit. He was that loved by Hollywood.
Well, that was my introduction. Jimmy DeMarit is a guy that I saw on I Love Lucy, and I was very, very young, but obviously those things have been a rerun for Infinita. I mean, it is amazing. And they're still as good today as they were when they were made, and no production studio, no television studio wanted to put Lucy and Ricky on the air. So Desilu was created. They did it themselves. But through time, they had different sports personalities on, and Jimmy DeMarit was one guy. And when they went to colorization and you saw the clothes on Jimmy DeMarit, who was a golfer, and at that time in the 60s, golf was, Bob will tell you, it was still kind of, it was certainly in its infancy, professionally speaking. And it was just coming into a new age, and once television took it, and with the Masters and Frank Cherkini and different things like that, it became an animal unto itself. But at that time, you're looking at this guy, his name is Jimmy DeMarit, and he's got this Southern flair, and he's got this persona, and he's you feel the warmth and such coming through the television. You're thinking, how is this possible? And this, you know, I experienced it, not just the first couple of times I watched it with him on the episodes, but as you went through life, you're like, wait, this guy is not only, we use the word flamboyant, but this guy is the total package. So no wonder Hollywood loved the guy.
Exactly right. He had it all. He was a comedian. He was a singer of songs. We sang together, did duets together. We became close friends because of music, and he liked the way I dressed. And he said, "Well," he said, "I love Ben Hogan, but I'm not going to wear gray all the time." Because you know, Ben always dressed with very lack of color in his clothes. It's either gray or black. And DeMarit changed all that.
But weren't they both Texas boys? I mean, obviously Hogan was a Texas boy, and Jimmy ends up in Texas in Houston for opening up a golf course.
Yeah, down in Houston, the Champions.
Right. So
you know, he died in a golf cart. He had a heart attack and died on a golf course in a golf cart.
I'm not sure I knew that, but that's very apropos, don't you think?
You know, Bing Crosby passed away. I think he was in Italy playing around the golf, and the Lord took him on that golf course too. So I've always said that, and I'll say it again when I get to my 99th I'm going to say, you know, I had a dream, and they said they wanted me to come to the pearly gates, and I told them, well, I'm not ready yet. I got things to do down here. They said, well, we'll think about that a little while. So, you know, I'm testing the powers to be, and so far I'm winning.
You know, there's only one guy that's lived longer than you, and professionally golf speaking, and that's Jackie Burke, who he lost not that long ago.
He died when he was 100.
Right. So, he's got you lapped a little bit, Bob.
I'm sorry?
He's got you lapped a little bit. You got a ways to go to catch up to Jackie.
Oh, my God. Well, the story about Jackie Burke that no one knows is when I played in the senior tournament at Onion Creek, this lady came up to me and she said, would you teach my daughter while you're here? And I said, well, I have to check with the merit first if you'll give me the opportunity to work with her after I finish playing. So for two or three days, I would finish my round and then give her tutelage. And after, on Sunday, when I was about to leave, her mother said to me, how much do I owe you? And I said, this is a professional courtesy to Jimmy DeMarit. And she said, well, I can't go to Florida to take instruction for you to give instruction to my daughter. Can you recommend anybody? I said, well, how about Houston, Texas? She said, I think I could do that. And I said, well, there's a guy named Jack Burke that I would recommend for your daughter to see and take instruction. Now, she was about 30 years younger than Jackie. So they went down to the Houston at the Champions, and Jackie started giving her instruction, and he ended up marrying her. And when I had my 98th birthday, I had called Jackie and the woman that I had him tutor when she became a hell of a player too, and of course he passed away. She's still alive, but I never realized when I introduced her to Jackie Burke that he would marry a young lady that was about 30 years younger than he was. So strange things happen in golf, but the beautiful part of the strange things is they're beautiful, and the memories are more worth than money.
Well, you got so many, and that's why we're having this fireside chat with you, Bob, with making time for Toski, visiting with the great Bob Toski, and hearing the great stories through history. And as you get past Jimmy DeMarit, and golf is starting to come into the awakening, you're the leading money winner in 1954, but it's in 1960 range where Arnold Palmer gets on the scene and television is attracted to him, and then the big three are developed. And those people were very instrumental and still are to this day. We lost Arnold a number of years ago, but not only Jack Nicklaus, but Gary Player is still going strong.
Well, of course, you know, Gary Player traveled from South Africa to become one of the great players of the game. And, of course, he was then accepted by Jack and Arnie and became the big three. But let's go all the way back to Francis Wemet.
Go ahead.
The big three, there were two Englishmen that came to Brookline to play against Francis Wemet. Do you remember their names?
Harry Vardon, I believe, was one.
And Ted Ray?
And Ted Ray would be the other. Big man, actually.
And they were supposed to have beaten Wemet, that the odds were 100-1 or something. And Wemet beat them in the playoff. So now you had the the big two getting to beat, get beaten by the big one, which now is three. So if you talk about the big three, it started all the way back to Brookline when we met Beach, Varden, and Ray to win the U.S. Open.
Well, isn't that kind of full circle for you? Because we met started out as a caddy as well, and
yes,
then had the top game. So
it's, exactly. And, of course, the golfing world was shocked. And, of course, they do have, as you know, they have a movie about we met and winning at Brookline and beating Barton and Ray. So, you know, when you talk about the big three, that kind of started something like Sarazen and Hagen and Jones. When Jones beat all the pros, including Hagen and Sarazen and all the great players of that era. So, you know, when you think about it, sports writers and the television people try to match three players. Today, there's no big three, right?
Right. You're absolutely correct on that. You know, it's interesting you say that because of those great players of your era and even before that, they were always the top echelon. But what those golfers didn't have was a guy named Mark McCormick. And that kind of brings us full circle because Bob Toski also has a Mark McCormick story. Obviously, the guy who started IMG, and it's such a much bigger thing than I think he ever envisioned. He's been gone now for quite a while. And Mark McCormick probably would never gotten his start if it wasn't for Bob Toski.
We got time for that story?
We got time for that story.
Well, Mark was going to Yale College and dating a Smith girl. He came to Northampton Country Club to play golf at the club where I grew up in. And we got playing together, and we got to be friends. And he was studying law at Yale. And then when he graduated from Yale, I think when he was at Yale, he was a junior in college, and when he retired, when he graduated from Yale, he came to me, and of course we played a number of rounds of golf together, and I actually taught his family, but he said, Bob, I don't want to be a lawyer. I want to become involved in sports and become a sports agent. And would you talk to my mother and father and give them an insight as to what I want to do? And so I met them at Hopkins Airport in Cleveland, and I sat down with them, and my first line to his mother and father was, your son can always be a lawyer, but he has a chance with an open field, because Fred Cochran at that time was the only sports agent, and he had Ted Williams, and he retired. And I said, this field is wide open for your son to become involved in, and I will help him to succeed by giving him players that he should hire. And, of course, the rest was history. Arnold and a lot of players that I knew that he signed.
Well, the influence of one Bob Toski. We'll be back to wrap up the show. And we're back with Bob Toski sitting around with Grandpa at the fireside having a chat. Actually, he is like the godfather. That's what this guy is. He is the godfather of the golf swing, as I have always called him. But you have influenced so many people, brought so many deals together unbeknownst to yourself, and you've never taken anything. Now, I don't know if Mark McCormick gave you stock in the company. You don't have to say so on the air or not, but, you know.
Here's what happened. I never signed a contract with him. We shook hands. He says, I'll arrange for you to have speaking engagements, and you'll probably be paid $10,000 per so I gave him, he said, I need 20% of arranging these speaking engagements with Bristol Myers and all these big companies. And the amazing thing about that, when he signed Arnold Palmer, at that time there was only a handshake, but eventually it had to go into, with lawyers, it had to go into copy, but... and his 60th birthday, two people were invited to his 60th birthday party up in Florida, up in where Bay Hill, where Arnold was.
Orlando.
Orlando. And only two players were invited to that party, one guy named Arnold Palmer and the other guy named Bob Toski. And... so you can see where I stood with Mark McCormick.
So you, as you've gone through life and you've taken all these experiences and you have shared them with so many people, and you know, we've always appreciated you doing that on this show. I mean, we we found our gem, we found our diamond, we keep shining it all the time because the Bob Toski is beyond phenomenal, and the, what you bring to the table is just unbelievable.
I think some of that happened when I was the youngest or next to the youngest in the family, and you had to share, whether it was supper, dinner, or breakfast, you had to share. And being the youngest, I had to share with the oldest in my family, and I think I learned to share and care. And if you don't care, you won't share. So I think that type of bringing up was something that was ingrained in my mind. And I always gave, not worried about what the returning monetary was.
Well, in the last couple of minutes we have before we close out the show, I want to talk a little bit about the Little Pro. There's a guy, Eddie Marins, who we lost a number of years ago, has long admired you. And every time I would say I was having Toski on the show, he would say, oh, tell him I said hello. Oh, that Bob Toski. You know, your relationship with those kind of guys, the instructors, had gone back decades as well.
Yes, of course, he's the first one that gave the correct explanation for swinging the golf club. Ernest Jones said, swing the club head. You can't swing the club head. You got to swing the handles to move the club head. And that's why you have a grip on the other end. And you swing the handle to swing the club head. And Eddie Marins was the first one that came up with the correct answer when he said you got to swing the handle to swing the club head. Because if you swung the club head, you'd have to hold on to the club head to swing the handle.
It's too simple. Golf is so simple at times. And, you know, you've been able to break it down so eloquently over the years. And it's those guys like you and the Little Pro that have made it so, in the mind, easy. Because people think too much about the game, playing the game, and put too much thought into swinging the club. Or in the Little Pro's hand, swing the handle.
We become over-analytical, and we become paralytic from over-analysis. So, you got to teach golf like arithmetic before you teach algebra and trigonometry. And the way they're teaching golf today is trigonometry before algebra or arithmetic. It's a new way of trying to get people to understand how to play golf, which is, to me, is misleading because... they're not ready for that kind of information that goes above their head. So we're living in a new era today.
You're always welcome to talk on this show anytime at all. You know that. The great Bob Toski, my guest on Tita with Keith Jones. Hope you enjoyed the hour as much as we enjoyed listening with Bob. But we're out of time. Get out there and practice your game. Bob would want you to. Practice, practice. Take your game to the next level, and we will talk to you next week. Take care.